Chapter 15. The sailing of a vessel direct for Jaffa brought a great number of passengers together, and our decks were covered with Christian, Jew, and heathen. In the cabin we were Poles and Russians, Frenchmen, Germans, Spaniards, and Greeks. On the deck were squatted several little colonies of people of different race and persuasion. There was a Greek papa, a noble figure with a flowing and venerable white beard, who had been living on bread and water for I don't know how many years, in order to save a little money, to make the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. There were several families of Jewish rabbis, who celebrated their Feast of Tabernacles on board, their chief men performing worship twice or thrice a day, dressed in their pontifical habits, and bound with phylacteries. And there were Turks, who had their own ceremonies and usages, and wisely kept aloof from their neighbors of Israel. The dirt of these children of captivity exceeds all possibility of description. The profusion of stinks which they raised, the grease of their venerable garments and faces, the horrible messes cooked in the filthy pots, and devoured with the nasty fingers, the squalor of mats, pots, old bedding, and foul carpets of our Hebrew friends, could hardly be painted by Swift in his dirtiest mood, and cannot be, of course, attempted by my timid and genteel pen. What would they say in Baker Street to some sights with which our new friends favored us? What would your ladyship have said, if you had seen the interesting Greek nun combing her hair over the cabin, combing it with the natural fingers, and, averse to slaughter, flinging the delicate little intruders, which she found in the course of her investigation, gently into the great cabin? Our attention was a good deal occupied in watching the strange ways and customs of the various comrades of ours. The Jews were refugees from Poland, going to lay their bones, to rest in the valley of Jehoshaphat, and performing with exceeding rigor the offices of their religion. At morning and evening you were sure to see the chiefs of the families, arrayed in white robes, bowing over their books, at prayer. Once a week, on the eve before the Sabbath, there was a general washing in jury, which sufficed until the ensuing Friday. The men wore long gowns and caps of fur, or else broad-brimmed hats, or, in service time, bound on their heads little iron boxes, with the sacred name engraved on them. Among the lads there were some beautiful faces, and among the women your humble servant discovered one who was a perfect rosebud of beauty, when first emerging from her Friday's toilet, and for a day or two afterwards, until each succeeding day's smut darkened those fresh and delicate cheeks of hers. We had some very rough weather in the course of the passage from Constantinople to Jaffa, and the sea washed over and over our Israelitish friends and their baggages and bundles. But though they were said to be rich, they would not afford to pay for cabin shelter. One father of a family, finding his progeny half drowned in a squall, vowed he would pay for a cabin. But the weather was somewhat finer the next day, and he could not squeeze out his dollars, and the ship's authorities would not admit him except upon payment. This unwillingness to part with money is not only found amongst the followers of Moses, but in those of Mahomet, and Christians too. When we went to purchase in the bazaars, after offering money for change, the honest fellows would frequently keep back several piastres, and when urged to refund, would give most dismally, and begin doling out penny by penny, and utter pathetic prayers to their customer, not to take any more. I bought 5 or 6 pounds worth of Broussa silks for the womankind, in the bazaar at Constantinople, and the rich Armenian who sold them begged for 3 halfpence, to pay his boat to Galata. There is something naif and amusing in this exhibition of cheatery, this simple cringing and wheedling, and passion for 2d/2d. It was pleasant to give a millionaire beggar an alms, and laugh in his face and say, "There, Dives, there's a penny for you. Be happy, you poor old swindling scoundrel, as far as a penny goes." I used to watch these Jews on shore, and making bargains with one another, as soon as they came on board. The battle between vendor and purchaser was an agony. They shrieked, clasped hands, appealed to one another passionately. Their handsome noble faces assumed a look of woe, quite an heroic eagerness and sadness about a far thing. Ambassadors from our Hebrews descended at Rhodes to buy provisions, and it was curious to see their dealings. There was our venerable rabbi, who, robed in white and silver, and bending over his book at the morning service, looked like a patriarch, and whom I saw chaffering about a fowl with a brother Rhodian Israelite. How they fought over the body of that lean animal! The street swarmed with Jews. Goggling eyes looked out from the old carved casements, hooked noses issued from the low antique doors, Jew boys driving donkeys, Hebrew mothers nursing children, dusky, tawdry, ragged young beauties and most venerable gray-bearded fathers were all gathered round about the affair of the hen. And at the same time that our rabbi was arranging the price of it, his children were instructed to procure bundles of green branches to decorate the ship during their feast. Think of the centuries during which these wonderful people have remained unchanged, and how, from the days of Jacob downwards, they have believed and swindled. The Rhodian Jews, with their genius for filth, have made their quarter of the noble desolate old town the most ruinous and wretched of all. The escutcheons of the proud old knights are still carved over the doors, whence issue these miserable greasy hucksters and peddlers. The Turks respected these emblems of the brave enemies whom they had overcome, and left them untouched. When the French seized Malta, they were by no means so delicate. They effaced armorial bearings with their usual hot-headed eagerness, and a few years after they had torn down the coats of arms of the gentry, the heroes of Malta and Egypt were busy devising heraldry for themselves, and were wild to be barons and counts of the empire. The chivalrous relics at Rhodes are very superb. I know of no buildings whose stately and picturesque aspect seems to correspond better with one's notions of their proud founders. The towers and gates are warlike and strong, but beautiful and aristocratic. You see that they must have been high-bred gentlemen who built them. The edifices appear in almost as perfect a condition as when they were in the occupation of the noble knights of St. John. And they have this advantage over modern fortifications, that they are a thousand times more picturesque. Ancient war condescended to ornament itself, and built fine carved castles and vaulted gates. Whereas, to judge from Gibraltar and Malta, nothing can be less romantic than the modern military architecture, which sternly regards the fighting, without in the least heeding the war paint. Some of the huge artillery with which the place was defended still lies in the bastions, and the touch holes of the guns are preserved by being covered with rusty old corselets, worn by defenders of the fort 300 years ago. The Turks, who battered down chivalry, seem to be waiting their turn of destruction now. In walking through Rhodes, one is strangely affected by witnessing the signs of this double decay. For instance, in the streets of the knights, you see noble houses, surmounted by noble escutcheons of superb knights, who lived there, and prayed, and quarreled, and murdered the Turks, and were the most gallant pirates of the inland seas, and made vows of chastity, and robbed and ravished, and, professing humility, would admit none but nobility into their order, and died recommending themselves to sweet St. John, and calmly hoping for heaven in consideration of all the heathen they had slain. When this superb fraternity was obliged to yield to courage as great as theirs, faith as sincere, and to robbers even more dexterous and audacious than the noblest knight who ever sang a canticle to the Virgin, these halls were filled by magnificent pashas and agas, who lived here in the intervals of war, and having conquered its best champions, despised Christendom and chivalry pretty much as an Englishman despises a Frenchman. Now the famous house is let to a shabby merchant, who has his little beggarly shop in the bazaar, to a small officer, who ekes out his wretched pension by swindling, and who gets his pay in bad coin. Mahometanism pays in pewter now, in place of silver and gold. The lords of the world have run to seed. The powerless old sword frightens nobody. Now the steel is turned to pewter too, somehow, and will no longer shear a Christian head off any shoulders. In the Crusades my wicked sympathies have always been with the Turks. They seem to me the better Christians of the two. More humane, less brutally presumptuous about their own merits, and more generous in esteeming their neighbors. As far as I can get at the authentic story, Saladin is a pearl of refinement compared to the brutal beef-eating Richard about whom Sir Walter Scott has led all the world astray. When shall we have a real account of those times, and heroes no good-humored pageant, like those of the Scott romances, but a real authentic story, to instruct and frighten honest people of the present day, and make them thankful that the grocer governs the world now in place of the baron. Meanwhile, a man of tender feelings may be pardoned for twaddling a little over this sad spectacle of the decay of two of the great institutions of the world. Knighthood is gone, amen. It expired with dignity, its face to the foe. And old Mahometanism is lingering about just ready to drop. But it is unseemly to see such a grand potentate in such a state of decay. The son of Bajazet Ilderim insolvent, the descendants of the prophet bullied by Calmucks and English and whippersnapper Frenchmen, the fountain of magnificence done up, and obliged to coin pewter. Think of the poor dear houris in paradise, how sad they must look as the arrivals of the faithful become less and less frequent every day. I can fancy the place beginning to wear the fatal Vauxhall look of the Seraglio, and which has pursued me ever since I saw it. The fountains of eternal wine are beginning to run rather dry, and of a questionable liquor, the ready roasted meat trees may cry, "Come eat me," every now and then, in a faint voice, without any gravy in it, but the faithful begin to doubt about the quality of the victuals. Of nights you may see the houris sitting sadly under them, darning their faded muslins. Ali, Omar, and the imams are reconciled, and have gloomy consultations. And the chief of the faithful himself, the awful camel driver, the supernatural husband of Khadija, sits alone in a tumble-down kiosk, thinking moodily of the destiny that is impending over him, and of the day when his gardens of bliss shall be as vacant as the bankrupt Olympus. All the town of Rhodes has this appearance of decay and ruin, except a few consuls' houses planted on the seaside, here and there, with bright flags flaunting in the sun, fresh paint, English crockery, shining mahogany, and see, so many emblems of the new prosperity of their trade, while the old inhabitants were going to rack the fine church of St. John, converted into a mosque, is a ruined church, with a ruined mosque inside. The fortifications are moldering away, as much as time will let them. There was considerable bustle and stir about the little port, but it was the bustle of people who looked for the most part to be beggars, and I saw no shop in the bazaar that seemed to have the value of a peddler's pack. I took, by way of guide, a young fellow from Berlin, a journeyman shoemaker, who had just been making a tour in Syria, and who professed to speak both Arabic and Turkish quite fluently, which I thought he might have learned when he was a student at college, before he began his profession of shoemaking. But I found he only knew about three words of Turkish, which were produced on every occasion, as I walked under his guidance through the desolate streets of the noble old town. We went out upon the lines of fortification, through an ancient gate and guardhouse, where once a chapel probably stood, and of which the roofs were richly carved and gilded. A ragged squad of Turkish soldiers lolled about the gate now, a couple of boys on a donkey, a grinning slave on a mule, a pair of women flapping along in yellow papooshes, a basket maker sitting under an antique carved portal, and chanting or howling as he plaited his osiers. A peaceful well of water, at which knights' chargers had drunk, and at which the double-boyed donkey was now refreshing himself, would have made a pretty picture for a sentimental artist. As he sits, and endeavors to make a sketch of this plaintive little comedy, a shabby dignitary of the island comes clattering by on a 30-shilling horse, and two or three of the ragged soldiers leave their pipes, to salute him as he passes under the Gothic archway. The astonishing brightness and clearness of the sky under which the island seemed to bask struck me as surpassing anything I had seen. Not even at Cadiz or the Piraeus had I seen sand so yellow or water so magnificently blue. The houses of the people along the shore were but poor tenements, with humble courtyards and gardens. But every fig tree was gilded and bright, as if it were in an Hesperian orchard. The palms, planted here and there, rose with a sort of halo of light round about them. The creepers on the walls quite dazzled with the brilliancy of their flowers and leaves. The people lay in the cool shadows, happy and idle, with handsome solemn faces. Nobody seemed to be at work. They only talked a very little, as if idleness and silence were a condition of the delightful shining atmosphere in which they lived. We went down to an old mosque by the seashore, with a cluster of ancient domes hard by it, blazing in the sunshine, and carved all over with names of Allah, and titles of old pirates and generals who reposed there. The guardian of the mosque sat in the garden court, upon a high wooden pulpit, lazily wagging his body to and fro, and singing the praises of the Prophet gently through his nose, as the breeze stirred through the trees overhead, and cast checkered and changing shadows over the paved court, and the little fountains, and the nasal psalmist on his perch. On one side was the mosque, into which you could see, with its white walls and cool matted floor, and quaint carved pulpit and ornaments, and nobody at prayers. In the middle distance rose up the noble towers and battlements of the knightly town, with the deep sea line behind them. It really seemed as if everybody was to have a sort of sober cheerfulness, and must yield to indolence under this charming atmosphere. I went into the courtyard by the seashore where a few lazy ships were lying, with no one on board, and found it was the prison of the place. The door was as wide open as Westminster Hall. Some prisoners, one or two soldiers and functionaries, and some prisoners' wives, were lolling under an arcade by a fountain. Other criminals were strolling about here and there, their chains clinking quite cheerfully. And they and the guards and officials came up chatting quite friendly together, and gazed languidly over the portfolio, as I was endeavoring to get the likeness of one or two of these comfortable malefactors. One old and wrinkled-cheeked criminal, whom I had selected on account of the peculiar hideousness of her countenance, covered it up with a dirty cloth, at which there was a general roar of laughter among this good-humored auditory of cutthroats, pickpockets, and policemen. The only symptom of a prison about the place was a door, across which a couple of sentinels were stretched, yawning, while within lay three freshly caught pirates chained by the leg. They had committed some murders of a very late date, and were awaiting sentence, but their wives were allowed to communicate freely with them. And it seemed to me that, if half a dozen friends would set them free, and they themselves had energy enough to move, the sentinels would be a great deal too lazy to walk after them. The combined influence of Rhodes and Ramazan, I suppose, had taken possession of my friend the Shistergisel from Berlin. As soon as he received his fee, he cut me at once, and went and lay down by a fountain near the port, and ate grapes out of a dirty pocket handkerchief. Other Christian idlers lay near him, dozing, or sprawling, in the boats, or listlessly munching watermelons. Along the coffee houses of the quay sat hundreds more, with no better employment, and the captain of the Beria and his officers, and several of the passengers in that famous steamship, were in this company, being idle with all their might. Two or three adventurous young men went off to see the valley, where the dragon was killed, but others, more susceptible of the real influence of the island, I am sure would not have moved, though we had been told that the Colossus himself was taking a walk half a mile off. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.